The truth and driving force behind rebirth is what is called karma. Karma is often totally misunderstood in the West as fate or predestination. It is best thought of as the infallible law of cause and effect that governs the universe. The word karma literally means action. And karma is both the power latent within actions and the results that our actions bring. In simple terms, what does karma mean? It means that whatever we do with our body, speech, or mind will have a corresponding result. Each action, even the smallest, is pregnant with its consequences. The results of our actions are often delayed, even into future lifetimes. We cannot pin down one cause because any event can be an extremely complicated mixture of many karmas ripening together. So we tend to assume now that things happen to us by chance, and when everything goes well, we simply call it good luck. And yet, what else but karma could really begin to explain satisfyingly the extreme and extraordinary differences between each of us? Even though we may be born in the same family or country or in similar circumstances, we all have different characters. Totally different things happen to us. We have different talents, inclinations, and destinies. As Buddha said, what you are is what you have been. What you will be is what you do now. Padmasambhava went further. If you want to know your past life, look into your present condition. If you want to know your future life, look at your present actions. The kind of birth we will have in the next life is determined then by the nature of our actions in this one. And it is important never to forget that the effect of our actions depends entirely upon the because the law of karma is inevitable and infallible. Whenever we harm others, we are directly harming ourselves. Whenever we bring them happiness, we are bringing ourselves future happiness. The belief in reincarnation shows us that there is some kind of ultimate justice or goodness in the universe. So if you were to draw one essential message from the fact of reincarnation, it would be, develop this good heart that longs for other beings to find lasting happiness and acts to secure that happiness. Nourish and practice kindness. Karma, then, is not fatalistic or predetermined. Karma means our ability to create and to change. It is creative because we can determine how and why we act. We can change. The future is in our hands and in the hands of our heart. Whatever is happening to us now mirrors our past karma. If we know that, and know it really, whenever suffering or difficulties befall us, we do not view them particularly as a failure or catastrophe, or see suffering as a punishment in any way. Nor do we blame ourselves or indulge in self-hatred. We see the pain we are going through as the completion of the effects, the fruition of a past karma. But if we do observe the law of karma and awaken in ourselves the good heart of love and compassion, if we purify our mind stream and gradually awaken the wisdom of the nature of our mind, then we can become a truly human being and, ultimately, enlightened. Bardo is a Tibetan word that simply means a transition or a gap between the completion of one situation and the onset of another. Ba means in between, and Do means suspended or thrown. Bardo is a word made famous by the popularity of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. The title Tibetan Book of the Dead was coined by its translator, the American scholar W.Y. Evans Wentz. The actual name of this book translates as The Great Liberation Through Hearing in the Bardo. Bardo teachings are extremely ancient and found in what are called the Dzogchen Tantras. The Tibetan Book of the Dead is a kind of guidebook or travel log of the after-death states, which is designed to be read by a master or spiritual friend to a person as the person dies and after death. It is designed for a practitioner or someone who is familiar with its teachings. For a modern reader, it is extremely difficult to penetrate and raises a lot of questions that simply cannot be answered without some knowledge of the tradition that gave birth to it. This is especially the case since the book cannot be fully understood and used without knowing the unwritten oral instructions that a master transmits to a disciple, and which are the key to its practice. Because of the popularity of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, people usually associate the word bardo with death. It is true that bardo is used in everyday speech among Tibetans for the intermediate state between death and rebirth, but it has a much wider and deeper meaning. We can divide the whole of our existence into four realities: life, dying and death, after death, and rebirth. These are the four bardos: the natural bardo of this life, the painful bardo of dying, the luminous bardo of dhammata, the karmic bardo of becoming. The natural bardo of this life spans the entire period between birth and death. In our present state of knowledge, this may seem more than just a bardo, a transition. But if we think about it, it will become clear that, compared to the enormous length and duration of our karmic history, the time we spend in this life is in fact relatively short. The teachings tell us emphatically that the bardo of this life is the only, and therefore the best, time to prepare for death, by becoming familiar with the teaching and by stabilizing the practice. The painful bardo of dying lasts from the beginning of the process of dying right up until the end of what is known as the inner respiration. This in turn culminates in the dawning of the nature of mind, what we call the ground luminosity at the moment of death. The luminous bardo of dhammata encompasses the after-death experience of the radiance of the nature of mind, the luminosity or clear light, which manifests as sound, color, and light. The karmic bardo of becoming is what we generally call the bardo or intermediate state, which lasts right up until the moment we take on a new birth. What distinguishes and defines each of the bardos is that they are all gaps or periods in which the possibility of awakening is particularly present. Opportunities for liberation are occurring continuously and uninterruptedly through life and death, and the bardo teachings are the key or tool that enables us to discover and recognize them and to make the fullest possible use of them. One of the central characteristics of the bardos is that they are periods of deep uncertainty. Take this life as a prime example. As the world around us becomes more turbulent, so our lives become more fragmented. Out of touch and disconnected from ourselves, we are anxious, restless, and often paranoid. This uncertainty, which already pervades everything now, becomes even more intense, even more accentuated after we die, when our clarity or confusion, the masters tell us, will be multiplied by 7. This shows us what the bardo is: a continuous, unnerving oscillation between clarity and confusion, bewilderment and insight, certainty and uncertainty, sanity and insanity. In our minds, as we are now, wisdom and confusion arrive simultaneously, or as we say, are co-emergent. This means that we face a continuous state of choice between the two, and that everything depends on which we will choose. This constant uncertainty makes everything seem bleak and almost hopeless, but if you look more deeply at it, you will see that its very nature creates gaps, spaces, in which profound chances and opportunities for transformation are continuously flowering, if, that is, they can be seen and seized. In fact, as the teachings can help us to understand, every moment of our experience is a bardo. As each thought and each emotion arises out of and dies back into the essence of mind. It is in moments of strong change and transition, especially, the teachings make us aware, that the true sky-like primordial nature of our mind will have a chance to manifest. The deeper our sensitivity and the more acute our alertness to the amazing opportunities for radical insight offered by gaps and transitions like these in life, the more inwardly prepared we will be for when they occur in an immensely more powerful and uncontrolled way at death. This is extremely important because the Bardo teachings tell us there are moments when the mind is far freer than usual, moments far more powerful than others, which carry a far stronger karmic charge and implication. The supreme one of these is the moment of death. For at the moment the body is left behind, we are offered the greatest possible opportunity for liberation. The reason why the moment of death is so potent with opportunity is because it is then that the fundamental nature of mind, the ground luminosity or clear light, will naturally manifest, and in a vast and splendid way. If at this crucial moment we can recognize the ground luminosity, the teachings tell us, we will attain liberation. This is not, however, possible unless you have become acquainted and really familiar with the nature of mind in your lifetime through spiritual practice. And this is why, rather surprisingly, it is said in our tradition that a person who is liberated at the moment of death is considered to be liberated in this lifetime, and not in one of the Bardo states after death. For it is within this lifetime that the essential recognition of the clear light has taken place and been established. This is a crucial point to understand. I have said that the Bardos are opportunities, but what is it exactly about the Bardos that makes it possible for us to seize the opportunities they offer? The answer is simple. They are all different states and different realities of mind. In the Buddhist training, we prepare through meditation to discover precisely the various interrelated aspects of mind and skillfully to enter the different levels of consciousness. There is a distinct and exact relation between the Bardo states and the levels of consciousness we experience throughout the cycle of life and death. So as we move from one Bardo to another, both in life and death, there is a corresponding change in consciousness, which, through spiritual practice, we can intimately acquaint ourselves with and come, in the end, completely to comprehend. Since the process that unfolds in the Bardos of death is embedded in the depths of our mind, it manifests in life also at many levels. There is, for example, a vivid correspondence between the degrees in subtlety of consciousness we move through in sleep and dreams and the three Bardos associated with death. Each of the Bardos has its own unique set of instructions and meditation practices, which are directed precisely to those realities and their particular states of mind. This is how the spiritual practices and training designed for each of the Bardo states can enable us to make the fullest possible use of them and of their opportunities for liberation. The essential point to understand about the Bardos is this. By following the training of these practices, it is actually possible to realize these states of mind while we are still alive. We can actually experience them while we are here now. It is because the Bardo states are all contained within our minds that they can be revealed and freed through the Bardo practices. The natural Bardo of this life is of the utmost importance. It is here and now that the whole preparation for all the Bardos takes place. The supreme way of preparing, it is said, is now, to become enlightened in this lifetime. The natural bardo of this life spans the whole of our lifetime between birth and death. Its teachings make clear to us why this bardo is such a precious opportunity, and what it really means to be a human being, and what is the most important and only truly essential thing for us to do with the gift of this human life. The masters tell us that there is an aspect of mind that is its fundamental basis, a state called the ground of the ordinary mind. It functions like a storehouse in which the imprints of past actions caused by our negative emotions are all stored like seeds. When the right conditions arise, they germinate and manifest as circumstances and situations in our lives. Imagine this ground of the ordinary mind as being like a bank, in which karma is deposited as imprints and habitual tendencies. If we have a habit of thinking in a particular pattern, positive or negative, then these tendencies will be triggered and provoked very easily, and recur and go on recurring. With constant repetition, our inclinations and habits become steadily more entrenched, and go on continuing, increasing and gathering power even when we sleep. This is how they come to determine our life, our death, and our rebirth. We often wonder, how will I be when I die? The answer to that is that whatever state of mind we are in now, whatever kind of person we are now, that's what we will be like at the moment of death, if we do not change. This is why it is so absolutely important to use this lifetime to purify our mind stream, and so our basic being and character, while we can. How is it that we come to be alive as human beings? All beings who have similar karma will have a common vision of the world around them, and this set of perceptions they share is called a karmic vision. Yet even within the human realm, all of us have our own individual karma. Each one of us is a complex summation of habits and past actions, and so we cannot but see things in our own uniquely personal way. Our human existence is not the only kind of karmic vision. Six realms of existence are identified in Buddhism: gods, demigods, humans, animals, hungry ghosts, and hells. They are each the result of one of the six main negative emotions: pride, jealousy, desire, ignorance, greed, and anger. Do these realms actually exist externally? They may, in fact, exist beyond the range of the perception of our karmic vision. Let's never forget, what we see is what our karmic vision allows us to see, and no more. Looking at the world around us, and into our own minds, we can see that the six realms definitely do exist. They exist in the way we unconsciously allow our negative emotions to project and crystallize entire realms around us, and to define the style, form, flavor, and context of our life in those realms. And they exist also inwardly, as the different seeds and tendencies of the various negative emotions within our psychophysical system, always ready to germinate and grow, depending on what influences them and how we choose to live. How we perceive the world depends entirely on our karmic vision. Everything that we see around us is seen as it is because we have been repeatedly solidifying our experience of inner and outer reality in the same way, lifetime after lifetime. And this has led to the mistaken assumption that what we see is objectively real. With most of us, karma and negative emotions obscure the ability to see our own intrinsic nature and the nature of reality, As a result, we clutch on to happiness and suffering as real, and in our unskillful and ignorant actions, go on sowing the seeds of our next birth. Our actions keep us bound to the continuous cycle of worldly existence, to the endless round of birth and death. So everything is at risk in how we live now at this very moment. How we live now can cost us our entire future. This is the real and urgent reason why we must prepare now to meet death wisely, to transform our karmic future, and to avoid the tragedy of falling into delusion again and again and repeating the painful round of birth and death. This life is the only time and place that we can prepare in, and we can only truly prepare through spiritual practice. This is the inescapable message of the natural bardo of this life. In Tibetan Buddhism, there is a basic, normal, elementary spiritual education, a complete spiritual training for the natural bardo of this life, which gives you the essential vocabulary, the ABC of the mind. The bases of this training are what we call the three wisdom tools: the wisdom of listening and hearing, the wisdom of contemplation and reflection, and the wisdom of meditation. Through them, we are brought to reawaken to our true nature. Through them, we uncover and come to embody the joy and freedom of what we truly are, and what we call the wisdom of egolessness. In Tibetan, ego is called dakzin, which means grasp. Ego is then defined as incessant movements of grasping at a delusory notion of I and mine, self and other, and all the concepts, ideas, desires, and activity that will sustain that false construction. Such a grasping is futile from the start and condemned to frustration, for there's no basis or truth in it. And what we are grasping at is, by its very nature, ungraspable. The fact that we need to grasp at all and go on and on grasping shows that in the depths of our being, we know that the self does not inherently exist. From this secret, unnerving knowledge spring all our fundamental insecurities and fear. Lifetimes of ignorance have brought us to identify the whole of our being with ego. Its greatest triumph is to inveigle us into believing its best interests are our best interests, and even into identifying our very survival with its own. This is a savage irony, considering that ego and its grasping are at the root of all our suffering. Ego plays brilliantly on our fundamental fear of losing control and of the unknown. And even if we were to see through ego's lies, we're just too scared to abandon it. For without any true knowledge of the nature of our mind or true identity, we simply have no other alternative. To end the bizarre tyranny of ego is why we go on the spiritual path. But the resourcefulness of ego is almost infinite, and it can at every stage sabotage and pervert our desire to be free of it. The truth is simple, and the teachings are extremely clear. But as soon as they begin to touch and move us, ego tries to complicate them because it knows it is fundamentally threatened. As soon as the teachings begin to touch us deeply, unavoidably, we are faced with the truth of ourselves. As the ego is revealed, its sore spots are touched, and all sorts of problems will start arising. As ego watches us gleefully become more and more ensnared in its web, it will even blame all the pain, loneliness, and difficulties we are going through as we come to know ourselves on the teaching, and even on the teacher. Ego is so clever, it can twist the teachings for its own purposes. Yet, however hard ego may try to sabotage the spiritual path, if you really continue on it, and work deeply with the practice of meditation, you will begin slowly to realize just how gulled you have been by ego's promises, false hopes, and false fears. Slowly you begin to understand that both hope and fear are enemies of your peace of mind. Hopes deceive you and leave you empty and disappointed, and fears paralyze you in the narrow cell of your false identity. You begin to see also just how all-encompassing the sway of ego has been over your mind. And in the space of freedom opened up by meditation, when you are momentarily released from grasping, you glimpse the exhilarating spaciousness of your true nature. As you listen more and more to the teachings, contemplate them, and integrate them into your life, your inner voice, your innate wisdom of discernment, what we call in Buddhism discriminating awareness, is awakened and strengthened, and you start to begin to distinguish between its guidance and the various clamorous and enthralling voices of ego. Gradually, you will find yourself able to free yourself more and more quickly from the dark emotions that have ruled your life. And this ability to do so is the greatest miracle of all. And when death comes, you will have learned already in life how to control those emotions and thoughts that in the states of death, the bardos, would otherwise take on an overwhelming reality. It is important to remember always that the principle of egolessness does not mean that there was an ego in the first place and the Buddhists did away with it. On the contrary, it means there was never any ego at all to begin with. To realize that is called egolessness. The way to discover the freedom of the wisdom of egolessness, the Master's advisors, is through the process of listening and hearing, contemplation and reflection, and meditation. They advise us to begin by listening repeatedly to the spiritual teachings. As we listen, they will keep on and on reminding us of our hidden wisdom nature. Listening is a far more difficult process than most people imagine. Really to listen, in the way that is meant by the masters, is to let go utterly of ourselves, to let go of all the information, all the concepts, all the ideas, and all the prejudices that our heads are stuffed with. If you really listen to the teachings, those concepts that are our real hindrance, the one thing that stands between us and our true nature, can slowly and steadily be washed away. Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche used to say, "The more and more you listen, the more and more you hear, the more and more you hear, the deeper and deeper your understanding becomes." The deepening of understanding, then, comes through contemplation and reflection, the second tool of wisdom. As we contemplate what we've heard, it gradually begins to permeate our mind stream and saturate our inner experience of our lives. Everyday events start to mirror and more subtly and directly to confirm the truth of the teachings, as contemplation slowly unfolds and enriches what we have begun to understand intellectually and carries that understanding down from our head to our heart. The third tool of wisdom is meditation. After listening to the teachings and reflecting on them, we put into action the insights we have gained and apply them directly through the process of meditation to the needs of everyday life. In ancient times, there were extraordinary masters and students who could, by just practicing with unswerving devotion one single instruction, attain liberation. Even now, if we were to put our mind to one powerful wisdom method and work with it directly, there is a real possibility we would become enlightened. Our minds, however, are riddled and confused with doubt. Sometimes it seems that doubt is an even greater block to human evolution than desire and attachment. Our society promotes cleverness instead of wisdom, and celebrates the most superficial, harsh, and least useful aspects of our intelligence. The vast truth of the mystical teachings handed down to us is not something that our endangered world can afford to dismiss. Instead of doubting them, why don't we doubt ourselves, our ignorance, our assumption that we understand everything already, our grasping and evasion, our passion for so-called explanations of reality that have about them nothing of the awe-inspiring and all-encompassing wisdom of what the masters, the messengers of reality, have told us. Don't let us take doubts with exaggerated seriousness, or let them grow out of proportion, or become black and white or fanatical about them. What we need to learn is how slowly to change our culturally conditioned and passionate involvement with doubt into a free, humorous, and compassionate one. This means giving doubts time, and giving ourselves time to find answers to our questions that are not merely intellectual or philosophical, but living and real and genuine and workable. Doubts cannot resolve themselves immediately, but if we are patient, a space can be created within us in which doubts can be carefully and objectively examined, unraveled, dissolved, and healed. The spiritual journey is one of continuous learning and purification. When you know this, you become humble. There is a famous Tibetan saying, "Do not mistake understanding for realization, and do not mistake realization for liberation." And Milarepa said, "Do not entertain hopes for realization, but practice all your life."
All the spiritual teachers of humanity have told us the same thing, that the purpose of life on earth is to achieve union with our fundamental enlightened nature. There's only one way to do this, and that is to undertake the spiritual journey with all the ardour and intelligence, courage and resolve for transformation that we can muster. To follow the path of wisdom has never been more urgent or more difficult, yet there is one significant source of hope in this tragic situation, and that is that the spiritual teachings of all the great mystical traditions are still available. Unfortunately, however, there are very few masters to embody them, and an almost total lack of discrimination in those searching for the truth. Recognizing who is and who is not a true master is a very subtle and demanding business, and in an age like ours, addicted to entertainment, easy answers, and quick fixes, the more sober and untheatrical attributes of spiritual mastery might very well go unnoticed. As Patril Rinpoche wrote, "The extraordinary qualities of great beings who hide their nature escapes ordinary people like us, despite our best efforts in examining them. On the other hand, even ordinary charlatans are expert at deceiving others by behaving like saints. If true, must it be in the chaos of our contemporary spiritual supermarket?" So how are we today, in an trustful age, to find the trust that is so necessary in following the spiritual path? What criteria can we use to assess whether or not a master is genuine? True teachers are kind, compassionate, tireless in their desire to share whatever wisdom they have acquired from their masters, never abuse or manipulate their students under any circumstances, never under any circumstances abandon them, serve not their own ends, but the greatness of the teachings, and always remain humble. Real trust can and should only grow towards someone whom you come to know over time embodies all these qualities. You will find that this trust becomes the ground of your life, there to support you through all the difficulties of life and death. It cannot be stressed too often that it is the truth of the teaching which is all important, and never the personality of the teacher. This is why Buddha reminded us in the Four Reliances, "Rely on the message of the teacher, not on his personality. Rely on the meaning, not just on the words. Rely on the real meaning, not on the provisional one. Rely on your wisdom mind, not on your ordinary judgmental mind." At first, then, more important than finding the teacher is studying the truth of the teaching, for it is through making a connection with the truth of the teachings that you will discover your living connection with the Master. We all have the karma to meet one spiritual path or another. Follow with complete sincerity the path that inspires you most. The most important thing is not to get trapped in what we see everywhere in the West, a shopping mentality, shopping around from master to master, teaching to teaching, without any continuity or real sustained dedication to any one discipline. Nearly all the great spiritual masters of all traditions agree that the essential thing is to master one way, one path to the truth, by following one tradition with all your heart and mind to the end of the spiritual journey, whilst remaining open and respectful towards the insights of all others. Following one teaching is not a way of confining you or jealously monopolizing you. It's a compassionate and skillful way of keeping you centered and always on the path, despite all the obstacles that you and the world will inevitably present. So when you have explored the mystical traditions, choose one master and follow him or her. It's one thing to set out on the spiritual journey, it's quite another to find the patience and endurance, the wisdom, courage, and humility to follow it to the end. You may have the karma to find a teacher, but you must then create the karma to follow your teacher. Even when you have chosen your master and are following the teachings as sincerely as you can, you will often meet difficulties and frustrations, contradictions and imperfections. Don't succumb to obstacles and tiny difficulties. These are often only ego's childish emotions. Don't let them blind you to the essential and enduring value of what you have chosen. Don't let your impatience drag you away from your commitment to the truth.
The Buddha says in one of the scriptures, of all the Buddhas who have ever attained enlightenment, not a single one accomplished this without relying upon a master. And of all the 1,000 Buddhas that will appear in the Sion, none of them will attain enlightenment without relying on a master. In 1987, after my beloved master, the Rinpoche, passed away in France, I was sitting in a train returning to Paris from southwest of France where he had lived. Immediately, there were thousands of acts of generosity, tenderness and compassion passed through my mind. And I found myself in tears saying to myself over and over again, had it not been for you, how could I possibly have understood? I realized with an intimacy and poignancy that I had never experienced before just why such a sacred emphasis is placed in our tradition on the relationship between the master and the disciple, and just how essential this relationship is with the living transmission of the truth from mind to mind, from heart to heart. Without my masters, I would have had no possibility at all of realizing the truth of the teachings. I cannot imagine even having been able to reach the humble level of understanding that I have. Perhaps the most moving and accurate account of the true nature of the Master I've ever heard comes from my Master Jamin Khyentse. He said that although our true nature is the Buddha, it has been obscured from the beginning of time by a dark cloud of ignorance and confusion. This true nature, however, our Buddha nature, has never completely surrendered to the tyranny of ignorance. Somewhere, it is always rebelling against its domination. Our Buddha nature, then, has an active aspect which is our inner teacher. From the very moment
we became obscured. This inner teacher has been working tirelessly for us, tirelessly trying to bring us back to the radiance and the spaciousness of our true being. Not for one second, Jaman Khyentse said, has the inner teacher given up on us. In its infinite compassion, one with the infinite compassion of all the Buddhas and all the enlightened beings, it has been ceaselessly working for our evolution, not only in this life, but in all our past lives also, using all kinds of skillful means and all types of situations to teach and awaken us and to guide us back to the truth. When we have prayed and aspired and hungered for the truth for a long time, for many, many lives, and when our karma has become sufficiently purified, a kind of a miracle takes place. And this miracle, if we can understand and use it, can lead to the ending of ignorance forever. The inner teacher, who has been with us always, manifest in the form of the outer teacher, whom almost as if by magic we actually encounter. This encounter is the most important of any lifetime. Who is this outer teacher? None other than the embodiment and voice and representative of our inner teacher. The master whose human shape and human voice and wisdom we come to love with a love deeper than any other in our lives is none other than the external manifestation of the mystery of our own inner truth. What else could explain why we feel so strongly connected with him or her? At the deepest and highest level, the master and the disciple are not and cannot ever be in any way separate. For the master's task is to teach us to receive without any obscuration of any kind the clear message of our own inner teacher and to bring us to realize the continual presence of this ultimate teacher within us. I pray that all of you may taste in this life the joy of this most perfect kind of friendship. Not only is the master the direct spokesman of your own inner teacher, he or she is also the bearer, the channel, the transmitter of all the blessings of all the enlightened beings. That is what gives your master the extraordinary power to illumine your mind and heart. He or she is nothing less than the human face of the Absolute, the telephone, if you like, through which all the Buddhas and all the enlightened beings can call you. He or she is the crystallization of the wisdom of all the Buddhas and the embodiment of their compassion directed always toward you. The rays of their universal sunlight aim directly at your heart and mind to liberate you. In my tradition, we revere the master for being even kinder than the Buddhas themselves. Although the compassion and the power of the Buddhas are always present, our obscurations prevent us from meeting the Buddhas face to face. But we can meet the master. He or she is here, living, breathing, speaking, acting before us to show us in all the ways possible the path of the Buddhas, the way to liberation. For me, my masters have been the embodiment of the living truth, undeniable signs that enlightenment is possible in a body, in this life, in this world, even here, even now, the supreme inspiration in my practice, in my work, in my life, and in my journey towards liberation. My masters are, for me, the embodiments of my sacred commitment to keep enlightenment foremost in my mind until I actually achieve it. I know enough to know that only when I reach enlightenment will I have the complete understanding of who they really are and of their infinite generosity, love and wisdom. I would like to share with you this beautiful prayer, the words of the great master, Jingme Lingpa, a prayer we say in Tibet to invoke the presence of the master in our heart. From the blossoming lotus of devotion at the center of my heart, rise up, O compassion master, my only refuge. I am plagued by past actions and turbulent emotions to protect me in my misfortune. Remain as the jewel ornament on the crown of my head, the mother of the great bliss, arousing all my mindfulness and awareness, I pray.